You're listening to Martin Amis and Patrick McGrath as part of Pen World Voices, the New York Festival of International Literature.
Thank you, Salman. Lord Amis.
Actually, I turned down a dukedom the week before last. Well, I thought we'd begin where we left off last night, and we came out of the event last night talking about E.L. Doctorow's reading, where he'd come to the conclusion that the human quality he admired most was doubt, not passionate conviction, but doubt. Which doubt is, of course, the basis of all scientific inquiry, and it's how we proceed through argument is by doubt. And I was saying that, I do not call myself an atheist. I think that is a little crabbed and a little premature. What I would call myself is someone on the far atheistic wing of agnosticism, waiting with some impatience for the last okay from science to say that there is no God or controlling intelligence of any kind. But we're very far from being able to do that yet. We're about five or six Einsteins away from being able to do that. We don't understand the universe. Why is it so, not only so vast, as Updike said, we don't need all, especially if we're the only intelligent planet in this universe or this galaxy, we don't need all this near infinity of black holes and red dwarfs and all the rest of it. As Updike said, an attractive splattering of stars in the background is all we really... But we don't know how galaxies are formed. We don't know why galaxies don't fly apart. Why is it so difficult, the universe? Why is it so beyond human understanding? Why does it take an Einstein to inch us forward? And that gives you pause for thought and for doubt.
Yes. There's much that clearly that we don't know, and so can't with absolute faith, which I think was one of the points last night that was being made by speaker after speaker, that any absolute claim to truth is dangerous in the extreme. So there's the skeptical, wary, doubting approach is best. If you are, though, an agnostic, even if you're on the far atheistic wing, does it not then make sense to do, I suppose, what Pascal urged us to do, or took it upon himself to do, which is if there is a chance that there is a God, shouldn't we be praying to him or seeking his approval?
On the off chance.
On the off chance.
What's his name? Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, recently refined the definition of faith, not only belief in, but the desire for the approval of supernatural beings, sounds very sweet, really, that you should want that. The thing is, do you want there to be a God? I don't. My father was asked by the poet Yevtushenko, he said, "You atheist?" And my father said, "Well, yes, but it's more that I hate him." And that seems to me a kind of negative way of wanting there to be a God. Uh-huh. I'd much prefer there not to be a God.
Yes. Why?
Because then that gives us free will. An all-seeing, all-predicting, all-determining God somehow lowers what it is to be human, and I want that to be, as maximal as it can be.
Yes. There was, I seem to remember you interviewing Updike some time ago, and he was talking about his God, I think, which is a distant God that, I've forgotten the theologian that he gets him from, but his interest in human behavior is sort of nil. I mean, and any God worth worshipping probably wouldn't trouble himself with the doings of us mere mortals.
Well, yes, and you know, when Michael Chang, the tennis player, prays for victory in the semi-final at India Wells, I mean, I think it's a very humiliating idea of a god who concerns himself with the tennis top ten. But that is the sort of illusion, isn't it? That that he's looking out for you, that he really cares about you, and that's where it all breaks down, because the variety of human suffering, very much points towards there not being a god, or certainly not one who is both all good and all knowing. He would have to be what William Empson sees in Paradise Lost, which is an angry and a jealous god.
Yes.
And Empson, I think wrongly, but very stimulatingly, says that Milton hated God too. It must have been very deeply subconscious, but
yes. Well, Satan does emerge as the most attractive figure in the poem.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. But Satan,
yeah,
indeed. Although his is a sort of parody of heroism, isn't it? It's a quest. He goes on a Homeric quest to do evil. And one critic, Northrop Frye, said that sort of pseudo action.
To do evil.
To go on a quest.
But to be defiant, to rebel.
To rebel.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a potent idea that there was a war in heaven. There was a civil war in heaven, and nearly half the angels rose up. The Casus Belli was God presenting the other angels with his son. But I think it's a wonderful idea that in heaven, where you lie on the duvet of the cloud, quaffing immortality and joy, and the pavements empurpled with smiling roses, you couldn't stand it another second, and you rose up and hurled over the crystal battlements into pandemonium, the land of all devils, sacrificing immortality. I mean, immortality of pain, just in the name of. Really of preferment, because Satan wanted to be promoted, and then this sort of nepotistic figure of Christ comes along and inserts himself in the hierarchy a bit further up.
Well, now, as luck would have it, you...
I've just thought of a sort of refutation I came up with of religion. And it's this. That never mind famine and plague and disease and cancer and the horrible complications that we all have to go through, that seem to be constructed by our worst enemy as if off a menu. Never mind all that. If God really cared about us, if he really loved us, he would never have given us religion.
That does bring us very nicely, I think, to The Last Days of Mohammed Atta, which by great good luck is published in The New Yorker this week.
This is a short story.
Where you've done all sorts of fascinating things, including solving the great Portland mystery with the...
Yes, in the 9/11 Commission report, it says that no one knows why Mohammed Atta and... the muscle Saudis, as they were called, went to Portland, Maine, the day before, on September the 10th, and then took an early commuter flight, cutting it very fine, to Boston's Logan, and then boarded the American Airlines plane that crashed into the North Tower. And I come up with a kind of rationale for that.
Yes.
Which is that he goes to see an imam. There's a lot of doubt in the Quran, well, not in the Quran, but in the Hadith, the traditions, which frequently condemn suicide. The Quran only says at one point, don't kill yourselves. But that the pronoun could well be "don't kill each other." But the hadith is insistent that that he who commits suicide, the dreadful, the atrocious crime of suicide, will die over and over again by that means in hell, forever and ever. He who throws himself off a mountain will throw himself off a mountain forever in hell. And this quite poetically several times in the hadith. So, as Bernard Lewis says, it's quite a theological gamble, the idea of suicide bombing, which I think we should start calling suicide mass murder. Suicide hyphen mass murder, that's what it is. Is a big spiritual gamble. And there has been a... They found a kind of... In Palestine, they've come up with a kind of loophole for suicide, which is that if you drink holy water from Medina, from the oasis, it preserves you for Allah, because the idea is that you are not the owner of your own body or of your own life. In fact, you're not the owner of anything in Islam. Your very saliva is owned by Allah. You can't do anything without a rule, and Islam means submission. But if you drink holy water, this you get over the catch of suicide. So that's why he goes. But in my story, Atta is in fact an infidel. He doesn't believe in religion. He's just doing it to piss off all the other his rivals in the planes operation team.
Yes, that's. I thought it was a very nice example of the banality of evil, that Atta should have taken this chance of sort of missing the Boston flight to Los Angeles, merely in order to taunt the man who came down in United 93, Zaid,
yeah.
Who didn't get to drink any of the holy water from the oasis at Medina, and therefore was destined to burn in jet fuel for the rest of eternity.
That's right. And if you read the story, you'll see that I, in a way, say that the Quran is right, or that that the Prophet is right.
And it's curious that sort of yet again time and evil have this curiously sort of skewing effect upon one another. I remember the first time we sat down and had a formal conversation for Bomb magazine, it was in 1987, almost 20 years ago, when a nuclear war was very much in all of our minds, and Reagan was president, and we anticipated or dreaded that a nuclear war would break out between the Soviet Union and the United States, and that we would actually have no experience. I think this was a Jonathan Schell idea, that nuclear war would occur so totally, so dramatically and suddenly, that we wouldn't experience it. There would simply be various forms of death. And our experience, only experience of nuclear war, would be the anticipation of it, which That's is right. what we had at that time. Almost as though this event, this evil event, would somehow sort of claw backwards in time and sort of pull us into it, which was what it was doing at the time. So that was our experience of nuclear war. And
the only experience of it we were going to get.
Yeah. The only experience we'd have of it. And here again, of course, in Time's Arrow, once again, you use time very inventively in order to make us see afresh the particular evil of the Nazi doctor. And here again, it's time in its eternal return.
Mm. Well, we're living through an odd return to the Reagan era, because the other resemblances aren't very striking, I admit, but the politician at work in the world today who most resembles Ronald Reagan in this crucial aspect is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Tehran. Because Reagan, if you remember, it didn't really emerge until he left office, was terrifyingly influenced by end time theology. And both he and Ahmadinejad have this idea. With Ahmadinejad, it's the 12th imam, the hidden imam, who's due to return. In Reagan's case, it was Christ. But the eschatology is the same, that Christ will return, or the hidden imam will return, after a period of war and destruction, apocalyptic war and destruction. He will restore peace and justice, and then and rule for 1,000 years, and then you have the day of judgment. They both believe that. And a very likely and very apt prelude to the return would be some sort of nuclear exchange. And Ahmadinejad is even spending public money on building boulevards to welcome the hidden imam. He's founded an institute to study and speed up the return of the hidden imam. And
how do you do that?
By having a lot of death and destruction. And the hidden imam business is very sketchy. I mean, he was the grandson of Ali, who was that's the figure that the Shias follow, and there was a terrible succession problem. This is all in the 7th century, where the next imam in the line of Muhammad, which Ali was, and the first three caliphs were not, they all started dying. And then you got Hussein, who was the great martyr, and this is the great tragedy and passion of Shia Islam, is his murder. Well, no, he stood up with 70 men against an army of several thousand and was killed. But one of the heirs disappeared, and with extraordinary precautions taken. Yes. Now, that's the 12th imam. And he's supposedly in occultation, wherever that may be at the moment, and will return down the boulevard being prepared for him. And there's great sort of competitive passion in Iran at the moment about how soon it's going to be. And they have one major politician saying, I think 4 years. And so I feel very strong. I feel that now we can be bold and push ahead, because I think 3 or 4 years it's going to be a hidden imam is going to come back.
But do we need to have had some nuclear warfare in advance?
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
I mean the Iran question is nuclear weapons give you terrible dilemmas. They seem almost designed to do that, absolutely insoluble situations. But the position of the West on this question is a philosophical and moral non-starter. A two-tier world where we have them and you bloody well don't, and forget it. And we're going to make new nuclear weapons, and we're even thinking of attacking you with nuclear weapons to stop you having nuclear weapons. Now, since Shia Islam, the overwhelming central core value is justice, and this is an epiphany of injustice. I mean, as Jonathan Schell again has said, it could all work out inconceivable with this administration, but if we said, right, we're going to cut down on our nuclear arsenals with perhaps a zero option at the end of it, but we're now in the process of diminution. And having done this, we now ask you to give up your program.
Yes.
And you'd have a chance there. But the current Iran against the world is very central to the revolution and indeed before that, too. It's every tradition in Shia Islam will resist this.
Will resist any cut.
Any bullying, or, any... Uh-huh. any pressure, they'll put up with anything, and by Christ, they put up with a lot.
So in your mind, the nuclear program is entirely and exclusively about creating the weapons that will then serve this eschatological purpose.
And that's why they can't have them. I mean, they can't have them. Sorry, but they can't have them. I mean, an irrationalist, an anti-rational state, which Iran certainly is. I mean, Islam is anti-rational, anti-democratic, anti-individualistic. you cannot have a nuclear weapon in such hands.
Yes. How do you stop them?
By swearing off them yourselves.
Rather than beating them up.
That would set the war on terror back. You know, Iraq has set it back, in my view, half a century. An attack on Iran would set it back another half a century.
Yes. As a novelist, are you working with this sort of information currently?
It's more to be written with the left hand, you know, not the right. But I'm having been a terrific ignoramus for much of my life, I'm now you know, tremendously interested in history and the big questions, and I can't sort of get out of the way. I mean, what do you feel? By the way, I noticed in your last novel, when people say "by Christ" and "God," it's lowercase. Is this a blow for secularism?
Well, actually, it is. Yes. Yeah, you know, you hand in your manuscript, and it comes back with all the gods and Christ capitalized.
Yeah.
And so it's necessary to send it back in again, saying that you don't want to sort of, you know, dignify these casual blasphemies with capital letters.
And I think lots of us have sworn off the capitalizing the personal pronoun. You know, when we talk of him, not with a capital H. You know.
Oh, him.
Yeah, him, yeah. Him, yeah.
Although there was a character in your last novel called He, who was, curiously enough, a woman, was capitalized.
Well, that's
sometimes at the beginning of a sentence.
That's right. Well, that's she was named after one of Mao's mistresses. And funny,
really?
And funny
Mao had a mistress called He.
Yeah. Oh. And funny enough, it's pronounced her.
Well, if I could just stay with that novel for a moment, it was Yellow Dog, and there is a sort of a resonance in what we're talking about in terms of these states that are squaring off against each other and threatening each other, and preparing to bully each other and possibly destroy each other, with what goes on in a lot of our novels, but I think yours in particular, where there is that, there has been consistently a struggle between often a civilized and a less civilized individual, and the violence between them has usually gone in the favor of the less civilized, the more primitive and barbarian of the antagonists has generally carried the day. Mm. In Yellow Dog, you seem to put the two into the same individual. Your man, Zan Mio, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is a civilized individual who then is traumatized by a blow to the head, and the what you call the anti-man within emerges.
Well, I looked into this head injury business, and there's a vast population of people who have been hit on the head, and then it's almost like manic depression, where you go to a psychiatrist and say, you know, my husband's manic depressive, and he said, okay, well, next week it'll be grand pianos. And you think...
It'll be what? Sorry?
Grand pianos.
Grand pianos.
And you go back to the house next week, and there's a crane is delivering a grand piano, and he's, you know, ripped open the roof to put it in. And he said, and the week after that, it'll be Rolls Royces. And you go back, and six Rolls Royces are parked in the drive. You know, there's a real, humiliatingly specific course for the disease. And with head injury, that's often the way it goes. You can be a good, you know, you can read The Nation and be very sensitive to all minorities and be a good modern person. Then you get hit on the head and suddenly you're a sort of snarling racist and a wife beater. And it's as if the primitive man reemerges. So I thought this would be a good way of dealing with violence in one individual.
Yes.
And then he does come out of it at the end. But he comes out of it rather changed. He's not such a good... I mean, he's a bit more realistic about... not such an ideologue about...
About being a
good guy.
Good guy, good husband.
Good modern guy,
right. Speaking of head injuries, there was a piece on news, I think 2 days ago on NBC News, saying that of all the serious injuries that the forces in Iraq have suffered, some 180,000, 130,000 of these have been from IEDs. And it seems that 80% of those IED-induced injuries are severe head trauma.
Yeah, yeah.
And that there are men and women returning from Iraq who, as your man Zan Mio, was reading books with one word on every page, severely mentally and physically damaged. And that seems to be that's the casualty most predominantly.
That's right.
From
they
this
say
war.
The signature casualty is the brain injured and whatever other injuries you have.
Yes.
In fact, I've had the very uneasy thought that I don't think is really defensible, but the casualties in Iraq, you feel when someone dies. That's a dreadful thing, but the amount of pain stored up for these people who come back missing limbs and with this terrible confusion and retardation of the brain.
Yes.
That seems to me as a sort of the tonnage of pain seems to me much greater there.
I'm just reading a book at the moment about the sorts of psychological problems that the Vietnam vets returned from that war with, the sorts of rages, the post-traumatic stress disorder, which hadn't actually been diagnostically defined at that point. It's by a man, I think, who's a friend of yours, Robert J. Lifton.
Right.
I wondered, had you spoken to him about, the Iraqi casualties and the sort of damage that is being done to human beings by...
His wife was there last night.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, BJ. There she is.
Oh.
I thirst to talk to Bob about that. He's a great man. And he's attacked all the great questions of our time. And the Nazi doctors allowed me to write my novel about the Holocaust. And I don't think I could have written it without him. Mm-hmm. But there was even a video game in the 70s called Crazed Vet.
Really?
Yeah. And what is the authentic figure, does anyone know, for suicides among veterans?
I met a Vietnam vet the other night. I was at a screening of a film called Sir, No Sir, which is about the resistance of men in the military to the war and the fragging of their senior officers and the desertions and the various other forms of resistance that soldiers were making in that war. And this man said to me, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can picture, I don't know how many names are on it, but there's 50,000 more. And he said more than that committed suicide
right.
after the war.
That's what I understood. And we've come a long way from that era in that the men and women coming back from Iraq have nothing but our love and sympathy. But those coming back from Vietnam were sneered at and spat at. And to have been through that and come back to ostracism and hatred at home is disgusting. And but we've changed in other ways too, thank God, in that I was reading up on the My Lai massacre. What year was that?
68,
around then. And the enormous resistance from the populace of America to any prosecution of those men. And, let's be clear that this was as bad as anything that's happened in human history with women getting, their breasts cut off and knifed in the vagina and killing of children and old people. As bad as, a berserk army unit doing all the things that historically men do in such circumstances. And enormous support for them in America. For instance, a country band wrote a song saying, the war song of Lieutenant Callie sold a million. Now, we haven't been behaving that way about Abu Ghraib, have we?
No.
No one's made a record about Lindy England that sold a million.
Now, are you saying that that support of Calais and the soldiers who massacred, I think there were 500 men, women and children in that village, was support not because they were under such intense stress that they were that these berserk states were created in them by the pressures of combat, but it was simply an agreement that was the correct thing to do to that village?
Well, I think just more because this runs counter, really, to the horrible treatment of the vets when they came back. It was more like a surge of bloody nationalism, I think. And it was from the right on the whole. I mean, this country band was not, you know, Frank Zappa. It was, you know, a lot of backy chewing hicks from the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
So two different wings of America, but you know, not the shame that I'm sure everyone in this room felt when Abu Ghraib came out.
Mm.
Also, not just the shame, but the calamity of it. In the war on terror. I mean, it's like a huge defeat and a huge battle, that.
Yeah.
To lose the moral high ground, to have the actual soldiers on the ground behaving with the same unilateralism and unscrupulous self-confidence
yes.
that Bush was showing on the way into Iraq. A horrible humiliation.
Yes.
And same with extraordinary rendition where you take some suspect to Syria and have him, you know, tortured, preludial to being murdered by you know, really experienced executioners.
Yeah.
You know, that is, it's not just a horrible failing. That loses, that's a great loss in the war.
Now, you're struck, I take it, by the lack of a sort of great, you know, great sort of upsurge of moral revulsion in this country at these sorts of...
Well, I think, as I was saying last night, I do think we're a bit stymied by our having had a generation of multicultural relativism. What there hasn't been anywhere is a huge upsurge of revulsion about suicide bombing. Paul Berman has done a brilliant study of this. When the Second Intifada began, not with stonings and stabbings, but with suicide mass murders, there was a huge upsurge in support for Palestine. He traces this very carefully and persistently, and it went on until the end of the Intifada, when Sharon came in and the crackdown began, and the Palestinians lost all their societal gains of the 90s, under Israeli tanks. It was at that point that support died down. And, you know, people were saying, the mayor of London, after the London bombings, was saying, that's what people do in an unfair struggle. You know, they haven't got F-16s, so they use their own bodies. You know, first question, do you want them to have F-16s?
Mm.
The second one is, it's not what people do. It's what Islamists do, because they've mangled their theology so that you get these tremendous rewards from it. It's an unbelievably disgusting thing, the suicide bomb. And I'll give you a couple of reasons why. It makes a human being regard another human being with a completely new level of revulsion and terror. So much so that look at what happens when the suicide bomber isn't even there. Like the summary injustice meted out to Menendez in London, this poor Brazilian electrician who was shot six times in the head. And all he was doing was sitting there reading The Big Issue. You know?
Yeah.
Or the bridge stampede in Baghdad around the time of Katrina, where 1,000 people were trampled to death because there was a rumor, deliberate rumor, planted rumor in the crowd saying that there were suicide bombers there.
Yeah.
And the terror is so great. And, you know, you look at someone else and you think, is he going to explode?
Yes.
And you know, you, this is José Saramago, the Nobel Prize winning novelist in 2002, where he says, yes, we come to the supposedly so dreadful suicide bombings. Yes, horrendous, I suppose. Yes, condemnable in its way. But Israel has a lot to learn if it doesn't understand the despair that makes a human being turn his body into a bomb and then from the audience. As if it's a sort of sempiternal ruse de guerre that you turn yourself, explode your own body. Yes. And in fact, it's almost a career move in Islamic society to blow yourself up.
Yes, yes.
If you don't, that's the only way to get to heaven. By the sort of fast track. Everyone else has to molder in the earth for centuries until they're poked awake by furious angels on the day of judgment and then, you know, interrogated and, you know, with hot tongs, and then the good ones get to go to heaven. But the suicide bomb has been there all along.
But that's based on a misunderstanding. Didn't you point this out, that it's a misreading of the word sultana?
Well, that's a sort of detail that the word for virgin or sultana, you know, the concubine of a caliph, should have been translated as raisins. So when you get to paradise, you will not be best pleased to find a little packet of sun-made sultanas.
Average content.
With the average content 72 written on the packet. But that's not the only benefit enjoyed by the suicide mass murderer. In the theology that's been cobbled together to make people do it, you can guarantee paradisal immortality for 70 family members.
Yeah.
Your family is hugely exalted by socially by your act. And until recently, you got $20,000 from Iraq and $5,000 top-up from Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
You know, if you believed in this stuff, you know, I would be a suicide bomber if I believed it. I mean, there's no contest.
At root, there would need to be a state of mind, which you defined in that story as, it sounds rather like an airline, which is pan anathema.
In his case, Muhammad Atta, I thought his face was so expressive of just hating everything that you couldn't get a face like that if you valued anything or loved anything.
Yes.
The face refused to go into that mold.
Yes. And I was struck, too, that it wasn't merely the deaths of the passengers in the airplane and the individuals in the buildings that were somehow the gleam in his eye, but of the war that would follow, and the war that would follow that, and the chains of wars.
Cycles of wars that would come. Yeah, I mean, it is a cult of death, and that's... Paul Berman calls it suicide bombing. Our reaction to suicide bombing is rationalist naivety, that... you know, the fact that they were doing this was seemed to be an index of Israeli repression. That it was so unhinging, this repression, and so prolonged, that of course they did it. It's reasonable to do it. We've got to stop thinking in terms of reasons, because we're not dealing with reason. And the whole Islamic hatred of America is abstract and irrational. And, you know, what it comes down to is something really strange. In the last words of the Quran says the real enemy is Satan, who is a tempter, insidious whisperer in the hearts of men. End of Quran. And that's what Khomeini meant when he called America the great Satan, the great tempter. America isn't a tempter. It's not tempting you. All it is being attractive. So, you know, what you've got to understand is, from their point of view, the main purpose, the main thing of our society that we've brought into being is the tantalization of Muslims.
Yes, yes.
You know, it never crossed our minds that we were doing this, but that's the end result.
Martin, it's about 1:45.
Yeah,
shall we open up at this point?
Anyone like to ask?
I'm very interested that the fiction writers are talking matters of politics. And I'm disappointed that you are so anti-Islamist when American cultures are getting huge sums for dropping white phosphorus and depleted uranium on civilians in Iraq. And when extremism exists in Christianity, in Judaism, as well as in Islam. And I just want to ask why this.
Well, we're not hearing from Christians or Jews. We're hearing from Islam, from Islamism, and this is a creedal wave and an astonishingly successful one that's emerged in. You mean the Christian fundamentalists? Well, there is that, but that's not actual policy. And there is always rational. We are a rationalist society. We admire rationalism, whereas Islam does not admire rationalism. It's the enemy. Well, we are great opponents of the Iraq War, but look at the record of Islamism, not Islam, in Algeria, 100,000 dead, and in Sudan, where the figure may be 1.5 million. You've got.
I think we did move towards the image of the West and the Middle East mirroring each other, as we talked about the, for example, the nuclear question and the injustice of the one saying to the other, you know, you shall not have what we have, and we shall use nuclear weapons. I mean, there is a sort of reflection. When one thinks about the Iranian leadership and the current American leadership, in terms of the fundamentalism that's common to both.
Yeah, and the mortifying side of George Bush saying that on the way into Iraq he was just wanting to do the Lord's will, looking for the courage to do the Lord's will. Absolutely horrifying that is, and you know, I don't think. Cheney, who's perhaps the dark genius behind it all.
Duck Cheney.
I mean, that doesn't go all the way down. I mean, there is a rational safety net, you know, I do believe that this has been a disastrous administration and set us back and much blood and treasure in what is going to be now a long struggle. And another reason why we should never have gone in is that Baghdad is the third holiest city in Islam. And this is a grief in the Islamic soul that will rage for generations now that we've gone into Baghdad. Sir.
Samus Nice wants to talk about her her quote, and he remarks, Samuel remarks how wrong-headed it is, that term, because...
What is the term?
Banality of evil. And he's saying how wrong-headed that term is because it falls into the Nazis' trap, or if that was the cloak they wanted to put on these horrible atrocities. And I was wondering if either of you had any thoughts as to whether... that was what Bella believed, or that was just what the character believed, or if you are in line with that way of thinking yourself?
That to use that idea falls into the Nazi trap.
I don't know.
No.
Why would it... I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand why it's a trap.
The character Samwer thinks it's a trap, because to call that kind of evil banal is what the Nazis...
Yes, so let's not forget let's not forget the evil of evil.
It was more the figure of Eichmann that that prompted Hannah Arendt. The very ordinariness of the man, but it wasn't that his evil was banal, but that he was a banal man who was committing acts of extraordinary evil.
But I think what Samler and Bellow meant was that that kind of neutralizes evil in a way, and we don't want that. So.
And the difficulty of portraying war in a way that truly makes it reprehensible, where there is nothing heroic or glamorous about it. Can you speak a little bit about the war on terrorism and what you as a fiction writer might, you think that there's any way fiction can grapple with this terrorist war in a way that will make it truly, will take any form of glamour out of it? Or any form of entertainment, while being readable somehow. I don't know. It's not very well put, but maybe you can make sense of it.
Well, Norman Mailer said after September the 11th that the temptation for the writer to jump in was enormous, and jump in immediately. But he said, and I agree, that with fiction, you need, maybe 5-10 years for it to sit for such a momentous change in how the world looks. You need time to digest it, to do all the silent work of silently thinking about it, not in words, but just evolving into it. So I think it'll be a while before fiction comes up with something about this new world we're in. What to call it, the age of vanished normalcy that we seem to be in. But it's a defensive war. And that's, that's a different undertaking than it's taken aggressive forms, but wrong-headed aggressive forms. But it's in essence a defensive war. Islam needs an enemy, we don't.
Martin, can you remember, do you have it off by heart, the line of Conrad's you quoted last night?
Yes, I did, where he said, just talking about religion, and he said, I'm much too interested in the natural world, with which we interact in a way that could almost be said make life an enchanted state, to have any interest in the supernatural. Which, take it any way you like, is but a fabrication common to all ages, which robs us of intimacy with the living and the dead in all their countless millions.
That's
an outrage to our dignity. And he said, I will never seek help from the supernatural in my imaginings. And talks about the imaginings of others, common to all ages, which fills all lovers of humanity with unutterable sadness.
Yes.
I think almost the best thing ever written about religion, generally. But I think all times look hopeless. And the ones that weren't obviously hopeless, you, at the time you don't notice. I mean, the 90s were a kind of golden age. And we had so much time on our hands culturally and politically that we could devote a whole year to Monica Lewinsky and a whole year to O.J. Simpson. But, that Monica, even Monica, and even Bill look as though they were living in innocent times. And then 2001, and we're plunged into another, global standoff with an unappeasable, agonistic enemy with irrationalist aims and dreams. And it's not, you could count on the Soviet Union basically not to do anything irrational, although, it is irrationalist in all kinds of ways. But you can't count on anything now. It's when you look at Iraq, you see that the militants, and we've brought this on ourselves, but the militants are now in that stage that Lenin described in War Communism as the worse the better.
Mm.
And as soon as you subscribe to that, then, you're like the witches in Macbeth. Fair is foul and foul is fair.
Fairly hopeless times.
No, despair isn't an option.
I wonder, have you seen the new issue of Foreign Affairs, Saddam's Delusions, that story?
No, I do see that magazine, but I haven't seen it.
Saddam was so enamored of Stalin and managed to achieve the negative perfection that you talked about in the Soviet Union to a T.
And these were his delusions?
Yes, all about how all his people in the field would report fake successes to him for fear of being beheaded and whatnot. And it's absurd. It's exactly like Stalin.
Well, he was an admirer of Stalin, and it's a haunting fact that in the 20th century, when the last of the Islamic empires were conquered and divided up by the West, that the Islamic powers were forced to look to Germany first for inspiration, and that cost them the Ottoman Empire in the First World War. But they went on being sympathetic to Hitler right up until his suicide, and sympathetic beyond that. And then they had to look elsewhere, and they went to the USSR. So the flame passed from Hitler to Stalin.
To Stalin, yes.
And the two figures most admired in the in the pan-Arabic sense in the last century were Saddam and Gaddafi. Not very inspiring.
Yes.
Blokes, really.
No. If we don't despair, what do we do? Where is the non-despairing impulse? Is it art?
Well, in your last novel, Port Mungo, it seems to be a sort of maelstrom of art seems to be a kaleidoscope of dreads, but yes, for us, I think it is. I think we sorely lack legitimacy in what we've done so far, and we should look to see where we are legitimate, and that is in not committing atrocities. So Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo. Extraordinary rendition. There should be much greater pressure on the state to make sure that none of that happens, because we are morally far superior, it seems to me, and that's legitimate, and we are rational, and that's legitimate. So I would and shore up that and make the moral and the rational more watertight. Parade this fact that we do not torture. That's a strength.
It's been pointed out that it's extraordinary that that question even needed to be raised in the first place, that George Bush had to make a statement denying and lying as he did so, America tortured.
In November 2001, I read an editorial in the Herald Tribune about whether it's a good idea to use torture. And I thought, oh, that's a bit quick, you know, 2 months after September the 11th.
Yeah.
But, I mean, governments always do react to terrorism with torture, and the British did it with the IRA, too. When bombs start going off, they start torturing. Yeah. It's the state's first impulse. And it has to be, you know, we've got to join in shoring up this one fork of our legitimacy. It's vital to do that, it seems to me.
Could I just digress a moment? Don't you think that, I mean, assuming the moral high ground is always a difficult task, I mean, eternally, it seems to me, I mean, you know, to play the bad guy is always pretty easy. In other words, a provocateur in any kind of situation. But then to assume, you know, that some degree of it, commonly referred to as moral high ground, I guess, I mean, you know, to assume the better, to respond to the better angels of ourselves is always a difficult task. And as a nation, it seems to me even doubly so in these times, isn't it? I mean, for example, I mean, I've heard some opinions voiced that as far as the attack on Iraq was concerned, there was simply a revenge killing at its location. That, you know, and Saddam happened to be an easy target, and to go after bin Laden at that time was very, very extremely difficult, and so therefore, the attack on Hussein, I mean on Saddam, was simply the easier of the alternatives, and to forge some sort of, all this business about spreading democracy and all that, some cynics would say, that it's really just a rationale after the fact that, of our having been there in the first place when we had no business being there at all, because after all, regardless of whatever the evidence was, the agnostic stand was simply that you leave your neighbor alone unless he attacks you, you know. And that had always been the stance of the United States, I mean, or of our nation. Isn't that true historically, or how would you work on it?
Yeah, it's often been said that if we knew about the Holocaust, and it had been taking place not in Poland but within Germany, we would have left it alone, you know, sovereign state. But that principle has been weakened recently, and intervention, you know, prevention has been sort of semi-respectabilized. But, you know, I don't think that... Bush said, I want to kick some ass, and he needed a Muslim enemy, and Iraq was the one he chose. I don't think, I myself don't think that the loss of legitimacy came over the weapons of mass destruction thing, because every secret service on earth thought he had them. Even the Iraqi one, I think, thought he had them. It was just that American power, and there's never been anything like American power, American hegemony, was just a thing of facts and figures before 2001. Then suddenly it was not facts and figures, it was capabilities, things on your table that you could do. And Bush, it seems to me, just completely lost his equilibrium and had a power surge, and one blessed by God, moreover. And you could see it in the way he walked and the way he talked, and, you know, like someone who was trying to pick a fight in a bar. Power surge. I mean, when Rumsfeld refers to old Europe, insolently, I would say back that we have a political culture and had for centuries that tried to have, you know, surge breakers in the leaders, so that the rush of power, which everyone has always agreed is completely corrupting, is at least checked. And for good reason, not just for hygienic reasons, because a rotting mind makes rotten decisions. But there's no culture of that in America anymore. And there was Bush, you know, embarrassingly obviously succumbing to a power rush, right up until an excruciating moment on the aircraft carrier, mission accomplished, and the flight suit, and almost swallowing his own tongue with the business of trying not to grin. Absolutely mortifying sight, that. And that was the great loss of legitimacy. Mm. Ma'am, perhaps this better be the last question, I think. Yeah, and it's far less intense. I mean, the person who seems to me on the right track in all this is, this is the way I would have gone had I been a benevolent dictator of the West, is the person who's on the right track is the daughter of the man who was perhaps the genius behind the Iraq War. I mean, Liz Cheney, who's doing this quite well-funded operation to raise women's consciousness in the Islamic world. And that seems to me the obvious way to go. Spend $500 billion on that. Lift consciousness. You know, what's the Islamist next move to that? To have a riot, to go on the rampage, to protect their Quranic right to beat their wives? That's why they're so behind economically, is that they deny themselves the use of the talents of half their people. It looks like a solution in that it's the same size. Women are not a minority in the Islamic world. I mean, it yelps at you, this is the way to proceed, and it's bloodless. I mean, it would be explosive, because beating your wife is Quranic. I mean, that's what you do if you suspect your wife of disobedience. Says in the Quran, beat her. But very hard to imagine a mullah getting up and saying, our holy right to beat our wives. I don't think that would go down terribly well anymore. Anyway.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information, please visit www.pen.org.